I've been asked to talk about a special Hindu concept which comes under the title Mani Pura. I don't know whether you're old enough, any of you, to remember Dorothy L'Amour in the moon of Manipura. Well, this is the moon of Mani Pura. This is a little more serious than she and Bob Hope and Bing Crosby. Pardon? D-O-R-O-T-H-Y.
I've actually put down here. Just because I don't like putting the machine on.
Well, for your sake, I'll put it on.
Thank you.
Only for your sake, nobody else must look. If you do it this way. I'm going to write it vertically. What's wrong, dear?
Not at the moment, you're not.
It's funny, isn't it?
Yeah.
I deliberately removed it to see if I'd get corrected. It was okay when I came in. This week's deliberate mistake. Now, usually this is written horizontally across the page, and you then tend to read it like a sentence with a beginning and a middle and an end. I'm going to write it vertically for ontological reasons. That is to say, for reasons of the hierarchy in the universe. So I'm going to put a magical word to begin with. Can anybody pronounce that for me? I know an Englishman who went away to India, especially to learn how to pronounce that word. And he came back and said he had learned the secret of the sacred Om. I'm going to draw a line under that one, because that means the pre-analytic wholeness of being in two aspects, the O, the intellective, non-substantial, and the M, the substantial aspect of the same. So it means the totality of all conceivables viewed in their simultaneity. It represents the omniscience of what is signified by the concept of God, including the concept of God. Now that is prior to analysis. So the next word must be analysis. And this is a very charming word. The M occurs again, but now it is subject to what is signified by A-N-I. Now, as you know, the A-N means a serpent running. When the serpent runs, shall I know you're a running serpent? I know you're a running serpent, one running serpent. Like this. Now, sometimes the serpent, being a little sensuous, excites itself by dashing across itself like that. And at that point, it makes a point or letter I pronounce E. As in Italian. So that point is the terminal vowel there. So imagine a running serpent suddenly crossing itself. You notice that in the crossing, it has made a closed zone here. If I do it very simply, it crosses, and immediately here, there is an island of being. Now the letter B was originally a sphere, then drawn on a flat surface as a circle, and signifies anything whatever that can be circumscribed with a line and therefore recognized as a form. Now the M itself means the substantial aspect of that sacred Om, not the intellective aspect, the substantial aspect, and consequently we must view it as demoted. You know that we use an aspirate to signify spirit, our letter H, and the soft form of it is a soft H. Can anybody pronounce a soft H for me and a hard H? A simple H, like just breathe with your mouth. That's soft. Now block it at the back of your mouth, at the back of your tongue. That's a hard one. The gentle one is the fifth letter of the alphabet, which in English is E and Hebrew is He, and signifies a threefold fourth form function. Very gentle. It means life without impedances. But when you come to the hard H, called Spiritus Asper, you grip it and life is then under control, and therefore the eighth letter, the H, signifies hierarchical control. Now the free spirit is represented by a letter which in English is A, so I'll put that here, A. That's the absolute. And that is above the concept of the O and the M as polar opposites. Intellective, non-substantial idea, substantialized body, which is simply the idea compressed energetically. The A is the absolute, so we could write it over the OM and let one arm of the A go down to M and one arm to O. That's what we call polarization. The tie in the middle signifies that they are not really two separates. There are two aspects of an absolute. Now, the absolute is utterly unconditioned. I want you to imagine this. An absolutely unconditioned sentient power. I'm going to represent it as consciousness with no object impeding it. What is it like? Think of your awareness. Think of your awareness without an idea to limit it, without an emotion to limit it, without an impulse of will to limit it. Pure, infinite consciousness. And when you see that letter A, think that is the thing referred to. It is a no thing. It is not a form at all. That is the R before the sacred OM, and the OM polarity now splits. The M comes down like this to here, but it has been demoted, because when you pronounce M, you have to close your lips. You close your nose as well, at the same time you can't pronounce it. So when you pronounce an M, there is an escape of N, just in order to articulate and express it. Now, the M is a mother letter, let me say it's the first letter of mother. It's a mem in the Hebrew, M-E-M, and it signifies a substantial aspect of being, and it is pure inertia, and it has no initiative and no form of its own. It is just pure glog. Can you imagine pure glog? Do you know anybody like that? Thicker than someone who's thicker than two short planks. I know some of those. And they're very, very efficient in business. And they make millions quicker than anyone else because of their glog. They see something and they close on it and they become terribly wealthy and very, very powerful. Unfortunately, you could actually sell them an imitation Turner quite easily, painted by Tom Keating. So imagine the M signifies second-class citizen, substance, the so-called female. Now remember, we know that all human beings of both poles, an intellective pole here, the O, and an emotive, substantial, body-orientated. Recently, when a North American Indian was interviewed and asked about the difference between man and woman, he said, woman as such, in North Indian philosophy, was she who ignores the dictates of spirit. And man tries to obey to his great sorrow the dictates of spirit. So we should think of this M as a closure, and therefore, being closed, it is resenting. I want you to imagine, I'll draw you a closed M. It has come from infinity and wound in and made a circle. The energy has come inside it and hit the wall and bounced off the wall and bounced again. It hits the perimeter like this, and it keeps hitting it. And it goes round like this, always hitting the wall. So every time it hits the wall of its own enclosure, it feels impeded. But if you close your mouth for a moment and hum, you will feel in a hmm that somehow your mouth is full of substance. Can you feel it? You can feel a vibration of energy. The air is vibrating. And that is what you mean by substance, namely resistance encountering opposition. The encountering of opposition is what we call resistance, and the experience of that makes us aware that we are physical body entities. We also have an idea of it which is not substantial, and therefore is merely an idea. We call that an abstract idea. So when we see the letter M, we must think that M is full of resentment. Resent means re-feel, re-sent, sentire, to feel. It continuously, when the energies come in from the infinite, beats about inside and gets very, very, very annoyed with itself because of the enclosure. But at the same time, it feels itself to be a being of substance and meaning, and it doesn't like to let go of that. If some of the energy bounces out of it by penetrating the wall, that bit of energy is suddenly launched into the void and feels void, and therefore it tends to curl back in again. So you get a cycle. Let's call outside there chaos, that is non-order, and inside here is potential order. Order because the word ord, rod, rota, all signify the spherical enclosure. Nevertheless, the polarity which was in the O and the M is now hidden in the M, and the M remembers that it was once free, absolute, and it resents losing its freedom, but is delighted in finding its substantiality. So if we divorce the male aspect of a human being from the female, and consider the female aspect alone, and remember that's an abstraction, because they always concur together in the same being, there is always a polarization of deep resentment at the limitation of being a physical being, and at the same time delight in being a physical being, because thereby we can demonstrate separately from other beings. Apart from that closure, we would not be separate. Here is another closure, if I'm lucky. And this being is not that being. It is separate from it, although it came from the same absolute. Now, Mani itself is translated as a diamond or a jewel. The word jewel is a Semitic reference and means God himself. You know, the word Jew actually means mysterious perfection of God himself, and the EL is the form, the first form of God, El, which in the Muslim world is Allah. Now, imagine the M is activating itself inside by filling itself up as much as possible with the energy. It's determined to eat the infinite energy outside itself and grow into a very big sphere full of what it called being. That's a verb, isn't it? Being is a verb. A continuous form, the ing. A self-consolidating, continuously expanding, continuously eating the infinite and evolving itself into itself as an absolute, appetible intent made manifest as a body. That means that the substantial aspect of being, whether it's in the angels or the humans or the animals or the vegetables or the minerals, the substantial aspect is frustrated by existing and delighted to be manifest. There is the mani in manifest. Now the word ma there means substantial activation. And the word ni means negative individuation. That is to say, we translate ma as an appetite for the infinite, trying to gobble up the infinite, and the ni is a negation of that. It is a control of appetite. Mani means appetival control by the negation of form. Now we have these inside us as a polarity. Now the O intellective there has become the N-I here, and the M has become the M-A there. It means a jewel, and it means pure self-substantializing, self-negating, individuated control. A diamond. Now a diamond, as you know, has a shape, and it is structured in a certain way. If you find one and examine it carefully and the appropriate magnifying glass, you will see that it's faceted internally. And a good diamond cutter can see the lines of cleavage, and he can then chip away what he doesn't want, and the result of that is a faceted being. Some of you may recognize the faceted being. That is a simplified diagram copied on the flag of Israel, and it signifies the faceted whole. And what is the difference between an O signifying wholeness without analysis, wholeness without formal separativity, just wholeness, like a whole or a Greek hol, a whole with no parts. Now, if we cut it in the appropriate manner, we can make it faceted. The light of consciousness shining through it comes out at different angles and displays marvelous colors. And this marvelous property of a diamond has fascinated the intelligent as far back as we can go in history. Always the diamond has been worshipped as the very, very type of being to be. So in Buddhism or Hinduism, or in the Far East generally, China, Japan, this mani, this diamond body, is tremendously important. And it signifies a being that was once an abstraction in the absolute, brought down substantially, and then counting its own appetite, man means to count, counting its own appetite and individuating the products of its counting, it has become a highly faceted individual. Now every subject matter we know that's different from another subject matter is a facet of our being. If you know algebra, and you know geology, and you know symphonology, or any other ology, clearly, precisely, definitionally, then the totality of that knowledge is your faceted being, it is your mani. And the I there signifies the individual who has done the work of negating his own appetite in order to discover his faceted hidden self. So whereas the wholeness is simply whole without form, the diamond, the mani, is the same wholeness analyzed into an infinity of facets. So instead of knowing all there is, he knows not only all, but each facet of existence. Well, if you count thoroughly all that you are capable of, all of it, you discover the facets of your action possibilities so thoroughly you can afford to relax and play with them. So the next phase is when you completed your mani phase. You have to bang reality to get something out of it. We will have padme. And that means lotus. And the lotus means play. Lotus is a very good spelling of the English lettuce. You know when you say let us pray, you might as well say lotus pray. That means if you thoroughly understand yourself, you know how to enjoy yourself. So then we have a fourth phase here, and this means that the OM has become HUM. Right? And I'm going to draw a line around here. I'm going to enclose those three because they are almost unanalyzed, but these three have been analyzed. And the O in the beginning has become a U down here, and the A up there, which is absolute beyond all definition, has now become the eighth letter H and means hierarchical. So a hierarchical differentiation of powers driving into the substance is the same OM, but now developed through self-counting and playing with that which has been counted with great joy because you know what you're doing. Now therefore, that particular mantra, that Om Mani Padme Hum, this cry, you could pour. Well, you can imagine it. This UM becomes in English like an NG. So you can say, hum. Now say it gentle. Hum. How do you feel? How do you feel if you say, hum? I mean, apart from being English, how do you feel? If you say, nice, gently breathe, hum. Now compare that, because that's before you've done your analysis. It's like somebody at a party, afraid to speak, in case anybody knows they've come. But when they've gone through this process of self-counting, self-negation, self-control, and playing with that which has been discovered in the counting, you say, oh, becomes, hum! That means you've got the hierarchical power to steamroller any pre-analytic oom that may be walking about. Now, at that point, you have to remember, otherwise you'll become a demon, a fiend, a hellish being. You have to remember the infinite compassion of the Absolute. You have become, I think I'll give that one up and try another. I think I'll try a red one. Mani, can you read that red? And Pula. Now that means the jewel, and this means a city. Mani Pula means a diamond city. You are the city. Your being, your very being, your physicality, your emotionality, your tactics, your strategy, your volition, your consciousness as a sphere of self-discovered being is called Pura. Now that pu means power, push, drive, and the ra means discriminative activity and therefore rulership. So you have built your own being, your own body, your own mind, your own heartfelt evaluations. These have been built into a special magical city that nobody else can disturb or penetrate without your permission. Your Manipura. Jewel or diamond city is the state of the attained man who has realized his origin. You see that same Pula in a lot of Indian names for cities. Jaipur, Singapore, and so on. All these various names with a Pura on the end are referring to this Pula. This power, discriminative activity. Now let's examine what the compassion of God means. Now you know that the compassion itself as a word signifies with suffering. Compassion. Passion is suffering, the prefix with. Together, suffering is compassion. Now, absolutely, there isn't anything other than that which is signified by that letter A. That letter A, the absolute, suffers itself. That is to say, whatever it does, it feels. Now, because of that, prior to creation, I want you to imagine its condition. Prior to creation, an absolute, infinite, sentient power, absolute, infinite, sentient power, feeling itself in its absoluteness, utterly unimpeded, unformed, unmanifest. How does it feel? Can we comprehend it? From the finite viewpoint of a human being, can we comprehend what it means to see nothing, feel nothing, and the nothing that we feel is our own absolute being? Not manifest, even to ourselves. Now, is it worth staying like that? No. And therefore it says, that God says, you get this in the Quran, God said, I was a hidden mystery. I desired to manifest myself, therefore I created the world. But particularly, not only the world, for the world is like a vast map. He created not only the world, but man. Man is the evaluator. Mani is the perfected man, individuated to the nth degree. He perfected man as his caliph, his measurer of the universe. Now you know that if you have a map of a country and you don't know how to read it, the map is not very useful, is it? As a matter of fact, when I was having a small cuppa today, there were some brilliant intelligences debating. One was Jonathan Miller. And the other fellow said, if you had a device that could show the structure of a motor car engine, and you put it under the bonnet, it wouldn't run the car. You have to have something that could interpret the diagram. And you'd need a man to invent the diagram and the map and the engine, wouldn't you? So individuated man, Mani, is actually the evaluator of the absolute intention to self-discovery. I was a hidden mystery. I desired to make manifest myself. I made the universe, but then I had to make a man who could observe the universe. A man meaning an evaluator. Therefore, man was made. He was made after the angels. The angels are ideological energies acquiring in eternity. Man was made lower, but destined to be higher. Because man can actually comprehend everything, whatever, that there is by simply comprehending himself. Why? Because all spheres are identical. It doesn't matter how tiny they are or how big they are. They're all functions of pi ratio, are they not? So that to analyze one circle, one sphere, thoroughly is to analyze all spheres. So if you then know, if you analyze yourself, you will know all selves. Like it says of Jesus, that because of his mighty works, people began to believe on him. But on that account, he didn't begin to believe on them, because he knew what was in man. So he abstracted himself from the mob, because he knew the mob perfectly, because he knew himself. He knew that every conceivable activity is a possibility for every individual. So, calm, passion, suffering with. The A signifies the absolute, infinite, sentient power, source of all things. As infinite, there is nothing whatever beyond it. So that what we call creation, at any level, is a modality of that infinite, sentient power, which is called the absolute. Now the absolute itself, in itself, for itself, has no finite limiting concepts or bodies such as we have. It has projected those internally, introjected them into itself to manifest qualities to itself which should otherwise remain hidden. So we all have inside us, every one of us, what every other being has inside them. So my friend Peter here has everyone in this room inside him. His wife there has everyone in the room inside her. He is inside her. She is inside him. So that when you are actually dealing with anyone whatever, you are really dealing with the absolute. And that's why he says, inasmuch as you do it to the least of these, you do it to me. Now the absolute is all there is, there isn't anything else, so whatever it does, it suffers the consequences of doing it. There's a lovely Hebrew saying that said, when God created, he arced, that is, encompassed and sphered beings. And he thought he heard them complaining. He thought he heard them complaining because he was at the level of thought at his abstract level. He was not yet tied down to the incarnation in a gross physical body. So because he thought he heard them complain, he listened. You know, if you think you hear a complaint, listen. Maybe there's short of shoes you could sell them. Maybe somewhere there could be business. So listen to the complaints. And he heard them complaining. If this creation is as good as he says it is, because he said, having seen his creation, behold, it was all very good. Now imagine the encapsulated little beings inside the great sphere that we call macrocosmos, and they're all restricted by the other beings in contingent relation pressing upon them. At the moment I'm speaking, some of you may be listening, and if the vibrations of the air emanating from me hit you on the eardrum, then you have a legitimate complaint. Unless you give me permission to speak. If you say to me, shut up, and I'm a nice, gentle, obedient fellow who knows the meaning of the sacred ohm, I'll shut up. But if I prefer home to ohm, I won't shut up. Unless there's a great body of opinion coming up here and bashing me. I wouldn't be surprised if you did. So, compassion means that in no way can the absolute origin escape the effect of its actions upon itself and therefore upon any creature that it produces in its creative activity. It's a wonderful word, that word in the Arabic for compassion, because in its basic letters it's RHM. And it means womb. Imagine that any enclosure is a womb. It's a room without the discriminative forms within it, that's furniture, waiting to be furnished. The womb is the possibility of a developmental process, and it has two characteristics. One of them is protection against outer chaos, and the other one is enclosure in here, so that you can actually get on with your work and be nourished. It is not accidental that one of the Manipura definitions involves connections with the navel. There's quite a host of literature, for those that can read it, on this navel thing, because from there the child, hanging from a placenta, there is being nourished and protected, swimming in an ocean of amniotic fluid. And the Absolute has involved and made itself a macrocosmic sphere, which is the big womb of total reality, and inside that it has produced lots of little ones, of which human beings are some examples. So that word, that Rahman, that Rahim, that compassion and that mercy is presupposed in the fact that there is nothing other than the Absolute. In a sense, the Absolute has no alternative, if he's playing fair, but to incarnate. So when he thinks he hears complaints and listens, he hears that they're saying, if it is as good as he says it is, let him come inside and see how he goes on. William Blake put that very simply: let God go into a circle and see how he goes on. So having heard that, God said, okay, I will. So he entered into incarnation in man. The first that he entered into is called Adam. Now Adam itself, translated man, is made of Ad and Am, Da, Ma, male-female in one body. Now this male-femaleness was like intellection and materiality in perfect balance. Now if you get two forces in perfect balance, can they operate? In perfect balance, yet two forces in opposition, do they move if they're equal? So, if the forces are exactly balanced, if the amount of energy in intellect is the same as in physical body, there is no motion. Therefore, symbolically it says, it was not good for man, Adam, to be alone. So then, experiments were tried, stimulated, offered it things, minerals, vegetables, animals. Whatever was offered was insufficient. So then the Absolute, functioning as the God, said, I have blown my spirit into man, but it's in too balanced a state. So we have to take out of man, half of him, which he will call developmental half. And you remember developmental, that's it. Eve means the developmental half. That's very interesting. If we were to write that in the Hebrew, anti-Hebrew direction like that, Hebrew would read it that way, we can read it that way. We've written the word Eve, and we observe a funny thing. One of these E's is facing into the V, and this V here represents, in the Egyptian hieroglyph, a male reproductive organ. In other words, the inseminator. And these letters are called Hey, we'll write it with H with Hey Hey, not Hey Hey, like that. And this one is a vowel or vowel. Now we've written two women, because that Hey is a feminine letter used to make feminine forms of nouns. We have two ladies with a man between them. Now we have to say, are there really two ladies, or is it two functional possibilities of one lady? According to the preferences of the male between them, when he looks for that which will stimulate him and make him develop. So when Eve is taken out of Adam, we've got Ad there, like that, We've now got a substantial aspect here, which is feminine. We've got an active aspect there, which is masculine, and a door through which they can pass like that. And this he turned on the sinister side of the shield here, feminine, has got her back to the developmental male drive, and the other one has got her three-face lady looking into that. So woman, by this analogy, has two aspects from the point of view of man. One is honourable, domestic, bearer of child at home, reliable, trustworthy in every way. And the other one is magnificent, belly dancing Arabian houri. Now these two aspects are at the back of man's mind, at the back of the male mind. He'd like someone to take care of the house, naturally. He'd like someone to cook the meals. He'd like someone to bear his children. And then mysteriously, he'd like her to be full of jealousy and joy when she sees him. That's his design. Now, every being is polarized and has a unifying agent between the poles. So the letter E has three parts. The head, the chest, the tummy. Then it's a threefold thing. The idea, the emotion, and the physicality of it. So one lady is showing her threefold nature to the man, and the other lady is turning her back on him. Now the sinister side, you know when you draw a shield like this, you call that the sinister side, and that the dexter side. You know that, don't you? Right, the sinister side is feminine, and she's got her back to her husband. Can anybody tell me why? Why is her back to her husband? Any guesses?
So she's got the
opposite. She's busy at the sink. Well, the cat's lady elsewhere. He's not busy at the sink. She got her three talents ready. So there is a general tendency in the male, shall we say, in the unenlightened male, to forget the lady at the sink who's got her back to him, and to be delighted with the lady with the three talents. She can think well, very clearly. She immediately responds very well. And she got a rather fulsome, comfortable tummy to put her head on. Obviously, in a pleasure-orientated being, this one has the apparent advantage. And as long as she has sufficient number of clients, she'll prefer it that way. Now, the person who knows the content of the whole shield is, as we've said, a Pula, a city of Mani. He has knowledge that everyone is identical if you examine them closely. Now, the compassion of God is the compassion of the Absolute, because he cannot in all eternity avoid knowing the results of his creative activity. Therefore, logically, in all justice, he has been required to descend into a being, and we are that being, the totality of all human beings in all history, past, present and future. All those beings add up to a man. That man is Adam Kadmon, cosmic man. The Adams have a similar term with exactly the same meaning, universal man. A universal man is nothing but the totality of all conceivable human possibilities. And we, each individual of us, have exactly those possibilities in us. So we're in an absolute condition of an absolute ethical categorical imperative to relate to each other in the full awareness that we're actually relating to the Absolute. How do we feel if we believe that for a moment? If we believe that when we talk to another person, or even look, there's my friend Michael Graham Jr., I look at him, do you know, I've interfered with him by looking at him. If I know that, how should I compose? Should I frown at him? Or lift the nose? Or look sideways? You see, he may interpret what I do. Like I say, there was a fellow the other day raised an ethical problem. He went like that to a policeman. Did you see it in the news? And it produced a serious discussion about whether that could be called insulting behaviour to the police. Although throughout the whole of the war we used it. And Boadicea used it long ago. And when she did it, she did it that way. And she said, if you kill one member of my family, another member won't get you. And that's what she meant, and that was the origin of the victory sign. You kill me, you touch the clan. The clan will revenge themselves. Now in this absolute compassion of the Absolute, it is an absolute awareness that every being, whatever, down to the smallest virus, is nothing but the Absolute in the place of that thing, being there what it is. And therefore the Bishop of Durham asked the question, do you believe that God incarnated in Jesus Christ? Replied, yes, it was God being Jesus in the place of Jesus. And God being the Bishop of Durham in the place of myself. Now we could all, if we understand it thoroughly, say the same thing. But if we did say it, we don't need direction from the Bishop of Durham, do we? You all know, don't you, it is written what's called the Now Bible, which she's published for you all to read, and in it it says there's a hierarchy of importance, is God, Runcie, Durham. And as Durham doesn't believe in God, there's only Runcie in the way. That's his analysis. But of course he does believe in God, really, that was a joke. Not mine, I quote. He believes that God is infinite intelligence, sentient power, that there is nothing other than it, and that in every single individual, microbe, or human being, that spirit has blown itself into that being to animate it, to vitalize it, to make it intelligent, and then suffered the consequences of the incarnation in it. Can we seriously sit down, as we are with our various deficiencies, and look at them, and say, this is God, here, being deficient, on purpose, for some reason, which, if you think very carefully about, we know what the reason is. At one point, somebody said to Jesus, here is somebody born blind. Now, which man sinned, this one, or his parents, that he was born blind? Now that meant to say they believed in reincarnation. Had this man, now born blind as a baby, actually in a previous life sinned so badly that he deserved to be born blind? Or was it the sins of the fathers that visited upon the children to the third and fourth generation of them that hate me? And Jesus replied, neither. This man was born blind that the works of God might be made manifest. And we actually need concrete physical examples, not only of heroes, but of every known deficiency. If you see a blind man, don't you appreciate eyes? Have you tried to talk to a thoroughly stone deaf person? Isn't it difficult? Have you tried American Sign Language with the thalidomide armless child? Wherever you see a deficiency, it is there to make you aware of what it is like to have the virtues, the talents that you have already yourself got. So there is no such thing as an evil evil. There is no such thing as a good good other than the Absolute. An evil evil could not exist, because actually being itself is good. Because through being, good is defined. The being is the definer of the good. You can't define unless you first be. So you can have good bads, but you can't have bad bads. There is no thoroughly thoroughly consistent evil. It could not exist. And that means that throughout the whole of eternity, throughout all time, in all worlds, wherever there is evil, it is only relative. Relative to some defined situation where a being bound and therefore finite, has made a definition of his own purpose. So when you use the word bad, say good bad. If you think a thing is absolutely good, and if you read a story written by a great writer about a being that was good, and so was everybody else in the story, would you pay £10 for the novel? Everybody's good in the story. They're all kind, intelligent, considerate, compassionate, and helpful. What a lovely story. Could you find a publisher that would buy it? No. Did any of you see Sebastian the other night? No? Yes? Where did that criminal voice come from? Who said yes? Show me your hand. You said you saw it?
Yeah.
What did you think about it? Do you think it was bad? Well, to say the least, it would make some people think, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
But Mrs. Whitehouse or Whitehead or whatever would complain bitterly about the opening, wouldn't she? But it's not a bad, it's a good. Because it forces people to choose what they would like to do to themselves. So we must remember that, and then we can understand why, judge not lest ye be judged. If you think something's a bad, get rid of it, you're wrong. If you thought in the finite world there was a good, with no admixture of bad in it, you'd be wrong again. Because the finite temporal creature is a throughput system with intake of food at one end and excrement at the other end. Now you don't like feedback of excrement immediately, do you? Like you eat and you go back into the mouth. You're actually saying I select, I ingest, digest, assimilate, excrete as a whole process. So in the time process there is no pure good without an admixture of evil. And this evil is a necessary part of temporal existence. And temporal existence is a necessary means whereby the Mani Pura can be built. Only by experience of good and bad jointly presented can we choose in what way we're going to cut our diamond and show facets. Now the final result of the processes of the evolution of these beings is that there are an infinity of faceted diamonds. And although there's an infinity of them, all the facets have been cut in a different order at different times, so each one is unique. That's a wonderful thing, but it says there is only one truly unique, namely God. But because he's unique, when he creates uniquenesses. So it's not that man is all the same and God is unique, but every individual man and microbe is unique because it's made by the unique. For unique intention to express an infinity of formal dynamic possibilities. You mean good?
Good. Or the more evil you recognize, does that mean that you are able to recognize evil?
Does it mean that if you recognize good, you are good, and if you are recognizing evil, that you are evil? The answer is yes, but you can't do one without the other. In order to cognize good, you must have an idea of evil in you. So you must have experienced evil to know that that is not this.
There's nothing about evil, but it's not necessarily your sin. It's a sin of your father.
No, it's a sin of God. Let's draw a sin of God. I'm going to draw a letter sin. That's a Hebrew letter sin for you. Amen? Now you can see immediately those two are close together, that one's further apart. So I'm going to turn it round and do it like that. I'm going to put there the tummy, there the chest, then a gap, and there the head. That is a simple drawing of a man. And if you put a point on that side, it is called shin, shine, enlightened. And if you put it on this side, it's called sin. Now if you put this one down here, that's intelligent enlightenment. And if you put it down here, it's genital subjection. You are a slave to the sexual impulse, if you stress down there. Now the whole being is nothing but energy. So that letter signifies fire, which is a symbol of energy. Now what happens? There isn't anything other than the absolute. And the absolute is a good good. Because the absolute has its absolute intelligence and knows that you can't know what is good unless you posit what is evil to judge you with. So the absolute good posits the bad. Yeah? To look at, to decide not to have it. Let's write the word bad. And there is an O like that, and two D's like that, and then we'll put a cross there like that, and that's one letter B, and that's another letter B, and here is a letter L between it. I've actually written the name Babel there as a symbol instead of linearizing. If I separate it, I've got a B, that one, turn the wrong way around, and a B there, and an L between. That spells blab, doesn't it? Do you know if you were to blab these secrets in the ancient world to the general public, you'd be put to death? You had to put the B's together like that, hold them together like that, and don't let ordinary, uninitiated, uncontrolled people know that there is not a bad bad and a good good. They had to believe the bad was bad in order not to do it. They couldn't choose bad is bad. And they had to know that the good is socially recommended. That's good good. It isn't true. But you cannot make a civilization in its early stages without teaching good is good and bad is bad, and never the twain shall meet. So, you mentioned the word sin. Now you can't think about sin without guilt, can you? And you got the concept of sin, don't you mean something you shouldn't do? And if you got something you shouldn't do, don't you think there will be punishment? And doesn't punishment come from this word? Power drive, negation. Yeah? Punire. To negate power. That is, if you make a mistake and sin, that is, act separately. Sin means separative activity, ignoring the whole. If you do that, you will be reduced in power.
Then again, that sin side, which you could say was the female lead side, is the part which is brought out to help the person develop anyway. So therefore, you have to sin to develop.
Do you sin deliberately? Or accidentally? Or under an external stimulus? You're saying you have to sin in order to develop.
according to.
But you can't sin consciously. You can only sin by being unconscious and stupid. No, of course not. When he became conscious, he was with the pigs and the husks and decided to go back home. When he left home, he said to his father, "Give me my share of the inheritance." That meant the amount of energy allotted to him as a creature. So he was given an amount of energy, went out and spent it without thought. And he finished up with pigs and husks. Pigs means obstinate people. Husk means externalities. So if you meet some very, very superficial, very, very obstinate people, have you met any of those? Have you? You've been creeping in the lowest pubs in town. No. Well, you think it's time to go home, don't you? I remember once I had a program on the BBC on one occasion. And they thought they'd have a lovely weekly performance, very cheap program. And they would show that the average working man in a pub could discuss political issues and show himself fit to vote. So they launched this series. Well, how long did it take to give it up? Well, the first night they had to say, "We can't do this again safely." They're all talking tripe to each other. Even very high educated people can talk tripe. Last Thursday, I was listening very late to Robin, what's his name? Knight, is it? Yes. Well, there was some Irishman on the program, and Robin was being very establishment. And they were disagreeing with each other for agreeing with their opponents. And he pointed out, you can't agree with him and him because they're saying the opposite things. And they all burst out laughing. Who says the Irish can't hold two contrary opinions simultaneously? That's a rotten Anglo-Protestant idea. We can say anything about anything being Irish because we are poets. And they would not let go of it. Now, poets are mighty powerful people. They terrified Plato. Plato wanted an orderly republic. But you know, in ancient Greece, there were Irishmen. Did you know that? Before they migrated... No, I'm serious. Before they migrated down the Mediterranean to Ireland, they were in Greece. Interfering. You know there are red-headed Greeks with blue eyes, don't you? Yeah, have you met them? Very interesting people. And very poetic. Well, they ruined Plato's Republic and made him write another book called The Laws, which practically contradicted everything he said. Because there are, and this is basic Islam, you must never think, if you've got a true interpretation of anything whatever, that this interpretation is the only interpretation. There are an infinity of facets on the being, an infinity of viewpoints. Aren't there? So we can never say, "I'm right and you're wrong." What are you thinking about? Most people don't actually think about the words and meanings when they use the word. Do they? No. You know what an acronym is, don't you? Can anybody tell me what an acronym is? Acronym. No? Not necessarily.
It's a word made up of initials.
Can you think of one? AIDS. You know the meaning of the letters? Or have you been stuck with the word? Have you got the meaning of the letters? Did you learn the word without the meaning of the letters? If you did, you're passive to it. You know what chlamydia is? No. those of you old enough, and there are not many here, to remember the last war in the middle of it, what did Pluto mean? Pipeline under the ocean. That's an example. Now many, many, many words that we think are words are really sentences cut down to their initials. And the people that don't know their real meaning are passive to the short form. What does scuba mean? Did somebody say self-contained underwater breathing apparatus? And what does it mean if you don't know its derivation? You're passive to it. It could be anything. Didn't the man that wrote Animal Farm complain very bitterly about the condensing of sentences into short words and making people learn the short word and react to it without knowing what he meant? And we have to be very, very careful with terms, otherwise we cannot become mani. Remember, mani means control your appetite while you evaluate its formal significance. Ma, substantial appetite. Ni, the negation control by the individual of every point in it, so that you really know what you're talking about. And then you can be pura, a city of power ruling itself. Either you rule yourself or somebody else rules you. There is no middle course between you rule you or somebody else does. They won't ignore you, you know. They'll use you if you don't use you. Right, to say it very, very shortly, the absolute compassion of the absolute is simply the logical result of the absolute being the only power there is, and therefore the only response able there is, for the creative process that we know has produced the universe, including us. Therefore, we have a duty to God, means God has a duty to us. Therefore, the incarnation of God in man is presupposed by him creating, and then, in all fairness, having to enter into the same kind of body that has been imposed on the creature man. And this is true of everyone, without exception. So we have absolute responsibility for each other. Absolute responsibility for each other. How does that feel? Doesn't mean we can't do what we're doing because we're busy considering everybody. The answer is yes, of course it does. Can we remember to do it? Well, that's difficult. We have inertia, we have original sin. Original sin means the sin of Adam in his stupidity when he reacted to an external stimulus given to the wife by a snake. In other words, if something comes from outside to you, to stimulate you to action, and you react to it without total compassion to your basic concept, you have fallen into sin. And if you see through the stimulus for what it is, it's a means whereby you become aware of some of your reaction possibilities in you, in which case you thank the stimulus, which is called a temptation, for showing you some of your own tendencies in you. Because then you can choose whether to subject, that means throw under, subject yourself to the stimulus, or whether you should go on center in yourself and become absolutely self-determined. Now it is said that when the sages first reach this level, they are totally paralyzed and can't do anything. It's only for a time, because then they say, well, the universe is not static. So I've got to do something. But the Absolute didn't do something except from its absolute compassion. Imagine that prior to creation there was an infinity of sentient power, and that sentient power was trying to manifest. And what is the condition of a sentient power that can feel a potential of actuality and can't realize it? How does it feel? frustrated and horrible. So the Absolute said, okay, you want to act, so I'll give you a universe and put you in it, and you can then act. And when you've learned enough from that, you can come back home. That's the returning prodigal son. Now that's fair. But he has to incarnate in man, the whole man, the cosmic man, in order to justify having created in the first place. Now if we want to improve, let's say to internally probe ourselves for to discover our own internal capacities of total creativity, absolute self-determination, then we have to follow exactly the same process whereby the Absolute created the world. Now the Absolute is omniscient, so he can't have accidents and he can't be unconscious of what he's doing. Now we find it very hard not to fall asleep, don't we? Mm-hmm. Now falling asleep is a very funny thing, it's simple. It's what you do if you identify with the finite and then go round and round in it. Because its stimulus value drops and constant uniform stimulation is reduced to no stimulation by repetition. You are then called dead in your sin, in your separativity, in your running round. Now how can you get out of that condition of total self-lockedness? Answer, if you're in that condition, you cannot get out without grace rescuing you from outside. Grace means free spirit. Grace is the freedom of the Absolute to knock the creatures about and wake them up from their self-sleep of identification with finitude. We have an infinite possibility of actions. We couldn't even begin to conceive all of them in any given time because it covers eternity. And we tend to fall into satisfaction with a very, very meagre output. I had 3 paintings sent to me to look at the other day. Actually from Marion. I must thank you for those, Marion. Very good. They are sight paintings. And they were beautifully balanced in colour, tone value, symbolism within them. And I know that she thinks she didn't do them as an egoic being. They certainly weren't done by an egoic being. They're too good. If she continues to develop in that way and doesn't break into egotistic cleverness, they'll manifest more and more and more of the creative content of her being. But the egoic self doesn't trust it. He wants to keep his hand on the tiller, you know. So where does it leave us? We are, whether we like it or not, precipitates of the Absolute, who has come from absoluteness through Godhead to God, to cosmos, to individuals within cosmos, to the human being, and everywhere, and nowhere where it is not, is the Absolute operative as that being, in that way, in that time and place. And that means now. How do we feel in our relations with each other if we do that? I know how I feel at the moment through talking. Warm. You feel warm? I know I'm radiating some of my physical warmth a little bit. So if my friend Peter would come a bit nearer, he'd get warmer. Unless through some concept or other, he's already warmer than I am. Are you? Very warm. I thought your temperature went up when you started introducing the concept of sin. You know you're actually sitting on the representative of hellfire. That's a funny one. I think I'll leave you with that one to think about. Thank you.